Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the founders, leaders, clinicians, investors, and journalists and politicians that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am the CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's Healthy Heart Check does the equivalent of the NHS Health Check in just 9 minutes using your phone. It's available nationwide on the high street in Boots, Superdrug, Well, all of the other major chains. And if you're interested in knowing what your heart age is and how your cardiovascular risk looks like, you can do it in a few minutes. If you want any more information, you can head to pocdoc.co, P-O-C-D-O-C.co. And thanks as ever to PocDoc for supporting the show. So last week's show was with Dr. David McLaughlin from Curb Health, and it was a super interesting show, brilliantly timed again by our producer Arthur, in the sense of it is summer, everyone is looking to live a little bit more, and Curb is the only scientifically backed addiction therapy app that aims to not just reduce but also help people stop drinking. Dr. David's way of phrasing it is that he works at the Priory. He's one of the senior addiction therapists at the Priory, which is the celeb rehab place. And he said that he wants to deliver Priory level care at Aldi level prices. And the only way to do that is through his app. So check out the episode 125 with David McLaughlin. I've gone through periods over the last few years where I've given up alcohol for, you know, quite a few number of months at a time. And it really rang a bell with me and sort of my own exploration with not drinking alcohol. So I can thoroughly recommend it. Thank you for everyone who's listening live. We love UK Health Radio. We love the live platform. We love Johan and his amazing team. There are tons of other presenters, so go check out their shows. They cover all kinds of different topics, but they are all really interesting and really vibrant. So it's great to be on the station. Thank you also if you are listening on demand on your podcast channel of choice. We now get downloads in over 50 countries every single month, which blows me away. And the numbers keep getting better and better, which is phenomenal. So thank you for showing up. I guess we must be doing something right. It obviously helps that we always have really interesting, really different, really unique guests, all in and around the health tech space or the healthcare space. So anyway, thank you so much for that. Thank you if you're watching this on YouTube. Hello, you can like see me waving at this point if you're watching on YouTube. And obviously, if you're watching the best bits or the clips on Instagram, you can find them on my page, which is on my profile, which is at Steve Roost. So S-T-E-V-E-R-O-E-S-T. We take the best clips and we flip them into lovely reels and clips and things like that and put them out on Instagram. So that's the admin out of the way. And now we can get on to today's show. Today, on today's show, we have someone who is about as close to health tech royalty as it is possible to get. Her career has seen her establish herself as one of the foremost voices of authority in the UK health tech scene, arguably in the European health tech scene. She has world leaders on speed dial. The best VCs, venture capital firms, won't make a decision on deals without her input. And she's mentored and supported generations of founders through her own personal angel investing, but also through running groups like the Cambridge Angel Network, which I'm guessing many people listening have no idea what that is, but it's one of the leading angel investment networks in the UK that has supported, I would imagine by now, probably thousands of founders in one way, shape, or another. And it's that angel money, the first money that comes in, particularly in high-tech ventures, PocDoc being one, that really helps. So Pam is the queen of Cambridge Angels and one of the crown jewels of UK health tech. And it's wonderful to get Pam on. Pam, how are you?
I'm fine. Would you like to introduce me more often?
Yeah, can I could be your hype man, because
Great.
anytime you go on stage,
Fantastic.
I could do the
Oh,
hype.
thank you. A little bit of hype.
So there's a huge amount that we can talk about, and for anyone listening that works in health tech in the UK, they may very well have seen you or spoken to you or come across you quite a bit. But I think it'd be super helpful just to start the show if you could just give us a tiny bit of background on your journey to this point, because you've done a huge amount of different things in your career, obviously all in and around health. But how would you describe your career to date?
Well, I did a science degree years and years ago, and I, you know, when you graduate, you've not a clue what to do. I knew I didn't want to do a PhD, but I got on. I applied for a bunch of graduate schemes. I got on the NHS graduate training scheme, which I'm not going to go through everything in this much detail, but it's quite important because a lot of senior people in the NHS, managers, did it. And I worked for a short time in the NHS, and then I got a scholarship from St Thomas's. Thank you. To do a graduate degree in the US. And then I did what I call the girl thing. I think too many women don't actually run things. They go into consulting, which is what I did. Stayed in the US for 10 years, did a lot of international work, and then came back here. And I've done it for the last 30 odd years. I've done a mixture of consulting and teaching, first at Imperial, and now I teach at the Judge Business School at Cambridge and do a lot with Cambridge University. And I've been portfolio for a long time, and I've always mentored a lot of young people. So that's how I came across, really, companies beginning to be formed. That was one of the ways I started angel investing. So yeah, I mean, my genetic code, I suppose, is health services manager, you know, the dark side, according to the doctors. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the I haven't met that many people that have spoken about the NHS graduate scheme. Does that still exist? What was that?
Yeah,
Was that a specific thing?
actually, it's very, very difficult to get on, more difficult than when I did it. And that you do a cook's tour. So, you know, they make you be a nurse on nights for a week. Well, they used to follow people around, find out how the system works, and then give you a halfway decent job when you graduate. So Amanda Pritchard had done it, the previous NHS chief executive. Simon Stevens before her did it. I don't know about Jim Mackey actually, but a lot of senior types did it. It's a very good program. I am still, it'll come over in this, I'm still a huge supporter of the NHS, partly because I worked in the so-called American health system for so long, which is
Yeah.
not a great one. So yeah.
We can get into that one for sure. So with this NHS grad program, do you of all that they'd like the, everyone talk the people in the system talk about the NHS all kinds of ways and things like that. Do you feel like they keep that a little bit quiet? Because I've not heard, I don't feel like they promote that. I'm sure they do at graduate fairs and things like that, but like I'm not sure necessarily that that is a thing that is widely known that that exists.
Probably isn't. I quite often, I think 2 weeks ago, I said to somebody, "Were you a trainee?" It was actually a chief exec of an NHS hospital, and they were.
Right.
So there's a sort of tribe of people who
Yeah,
recognize
you've
each
been
other.
through it.
Yeah, but it's not that widely known. But managers are consistently bashed, and
Yeah.
one of my bugbears is we really need good middle managers in all industries, but particularly in health. And we tend to bash them and we laud doctors and nurses and clinicians, which is good, they're marvelous, but sometimes you really need some management expertise in the middle.
And how, and I'm not, I don't know whether you know this, and it's only just because you just asked that I'm asking, but what is the ratio? How many managers does it take to, this sounds like a joke, like change a light bulb. That's not what I mean. How many managers does it take, do you think, to run an efficient hospital trust, for example? What are we talking about?
I don't think I can answer that
That's
because
okay.
how many, there are lots of managers who came up the nursing route. They're really good. There's obviously quite a lot of doctors that are part-time. It's difficult to quantify it, see, but there are some middle managers that are less than great. So this is what all the medics complain about. I'm married to a medic, so I live with this. So it's difficult to quantify. Not enough good ones, I'd say. Not enough good ones.
I guess that's what the graduate program is trying to solve.
Yeah, good. We should have more of them.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it should be a badge of honor, right? In some way. So how you mentioned that you then went off to the US, and I it sounds like you didn't think very much of the American healthcare system.
No, I mean it. America. I had a great time, and I had some great jobs. No, the American system, and it's going to get worse. So I mean, it's the best healthcare in the world. There is no doubt.
Okay.
Cancer, MD Anderson in Houston, Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, Mayo Clinic, which was near where I was working in the Twin Cities. Amazing care. But if you are a poor person in Alabama or Arkansas, Lord help you at the moment with the Medicaid cuts,
Right.
it's not great for the underprivileged. And they spend trillions on health, biggest GDP in the world, percentage spend, it's approaching 20% of the biggest GDP in the world.
Wow.
So its outcomes are not really good for that investment. So no, but it's a great place to work. Innovation's fantastic. People are really up for it. They don't mind if you fail. No, it's a great atmosphere to work in, but I don't like the health system there.
And were you in a healthcare role, or were you just...
Yeah, when I graduated, I worked with a diversified health system that became is now Allina, and it's a big diversified system, insurance and providers and doctors and integrated system. So I was in what we then called corporate planning, visiting hospitals around the Midwest. It was fun. Yeah, it was
Bet.
good. And
Yeah.
worked overseas a bit as well.
Okay. And what kind of prompted you to come back to the UK?
Oh gosh, it's a personal question, but it's a good one. My mum had died, and I was 33. But it wasn't actually her dying was part of it, but I just actually got sick of the dollar driving absolutely everything. They're very good
Right.
at it. They're very good at knowing everything about the financial system, not just in health, but and also having 3 days holiday a year. That really bothered me. They don't have a lot of vacation.
Yeah, they
But I
don't.
just thought time to go back. And then I happened to meet my husband in America. Well, that was
Okay.
handy because he was British, so
Oh,
yeah.
that's good. So you could bring him back with you.
All fell into place, yeah.
Okay. So where does this idea works? When we started PopDoc all those years ago, in Cambridge, one of the questions that we got asked quite a bit, which was, so what does Pam think? And I was like, what? I was like, first few times, I was
This
like, I don't know
woman.
who Pam is. Or should I know who Pam is? And so how did this you evolve into a sort of, guru slash sensei slash kind of somebody whose opinion about things mattered in that way? Like how what was that journey? Because it doesn't happen overnight, obviously, but how did that sort of evolve?
I think because I had started to invest, and because I had some success, I think people thought, well, she knows what she's talking about, which is dangerous. But also, if it was Cambridge Angels, I can tell you the story of joining Cambridge Angels if you want, but
Yeah.
there are a lot of people, very, very good people, who make money in other industries. So, AI these days, engineering, software, quantum, B2B SaaS. And they look at health and go, oh, that looks value driven and interesting. I'd like to do something useful with my money, but they don't understand health, even the really, really sophisticated ones. So I think that could be partly behind, let's ask Pam. And I would sort of dangerously probably give an opinion, but I also sit in a network of people and I ask their opinions too, and we triangulate. And they know I know a lot of people, I suppose, in the system of health delivery, but also in investing. Yeah. But I should give you a warning now that I have made mistakes. I've not invested in great companies, and I've invested in companies that didn't do very well. It doesn't
Yeah,
always go well.
that's the way of it. What were the first few investments that you made?
Well, I was given some money in an Australian company, and I hadn't a clue. I thought, "Oh, that's nice," and as in lieu of fees, and it did really well. So I thought, "Oh, that's good." And then the second company, WellFrames, just exited in the US. Again, I put money in two very really great founders, one Brit, one American. And I've said this many times. I didn't know at that point about EIS, about the tax. The amazing tax beneficial scheme in the UK. And I'd done those two, and then I started to look at other companies. And when I was with founders, I'd say, well, can I put a bit in? I should say I'm very early stage. So I'm not like, you know, hugely wealthy with 50 or 100 grand to whang into things. I put in small amounts. And so it sort of built up gradually. And then, people get to know you. People say to me, well, how do you find your deals? And I said, well, it's not like that. They find you. People will find you. I get now, although to be fair, two of them are bonkers, I get about four emails a day. I used to get two with investment decks. Now I'm on, since the AIification of business development in the US, they try and personalize emails to me. And they go, hey, Pam, which I said before is frankly
Hey, Pam.
a bit abusive. Hey, Pam.
Yeah, hey, Pam.
And then they sort of try anyway. So I just always go, no, thank you. But seriously, people do find us angels. And then we angels all talk to each other as well. So there are many, many, many more deals that we look at than we invest in. So yeah.
We're a broad church, so how would you define the value of an angel network like Cambridge Angels for those of them,
Oh,
those
it's
people listening?
fantastic. I think just to follow on from that point I just made, that I have a list, on my desk somewhere, of angels interested in health tech. That I do digital health, pretty much software, tech-enabled health services. I've strayed into other areas because of Cambridge Angels. So we talk to each other. Now, Cambridge Angels was founded in 2001, and it was dot-com time, and a lot of young people, mostly men, made a lot of money and founded Cambridge Angels. We keep the membership at 60. There are lots of angel groups with many, many more than that, but we do it deliberately. So there's a community of people that know each other. And within that community, we have, I should say, three quarters of our members, not me, are exited entrepreneurs. They've sold their companies. So if you sold your company, Dave, we go, oh, there's an interesting person. And they, again, are in life sciences, biotech, engineering, software, quantum now, AI, obviously. Yeah, so we know each other. 60 is enough so you can know broadly, and you certainly know the people in your sector. And I'm convinced, and I've said this in public to Cambridge Angels, that in addition to recycling the money they've made and taking the risk, because taking the risk is quite adrenaline junkie-ish, you know, you get addicted to it, that people, they really like helping the companies, which I do. I
Yeah,
love
I mean,
that.
I think that one of the biggest things around angel investors is that they care, right? They're doing it off their own balance sheet, so to speak, out of their
Yeah.
own personal account. They're doing it because they genuinely want to help. And they might
Yeah.
have their own conditions, like, well, I'm only interested in this type of a company, or I'm
Yeah.
only interested in founders that look like this or behave that way or whatever. But they ultimately are so early and investing
Yeah.
oftentimes off of so little that it
Yeah.
has to be a passion and a desire to do more.
And I think the key thing that, again, I don't have is the experience of scaling a company. It's not easy to start one, you know, but it's easier to set it up and start it and get that seed money than it is to scale to Series A or beyond. And a lot of people in Cambridge Angels have actually done that, and they help their investee companies to do it.
Yeah, I think that's great. Look, we are going to go for our first break now, and then return with the second part of today's show with my guest today, Pam Garside, who is one of the leading authority figures in the UK digital health and health tech scene and chair of the Cambridge Angels. We will be right back in 2 minutes.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, the wonderful Pam Garside, who is one of the leading authority figures in UK health, UK health tech, and digital health, and who chairs one of the leading angel networks in the UK, which is called Cambridge Angels. So, what for those listening, what do you think, in your experience of dealing with investing, but also being alongside investors into early stage health tech, digital health businesses, what are some of the key qualities that you look for in the founders, but also in the business? And I think that last bit's really interesting because there might not even really be a business at that point. So what is it that you're looking for to try and drive your decisions?
It's because I do very early stage, pre-seed, if I can, if one can, because one doesn't have much money, so you want to be pre-seed. It's the founder and the founding team. And I used to think it was just me, and it isn't. All of us angels think that. It's the founding team, ideally more than one founder, and then you look at their product or service, and you know it won't have product market fit, but is it likely to? I'll mention Accurics because I think Jacob doesn't mind me. One of my successful investments is Accurics, which is a communications platform in health. And when I invested, it was the software was to discourage GPs from prescribing antibiotics. That's what I invested in. So several of my colleagues said, "Are you mad?" They actually, it was a swear word inserted there. And they now go, "Oh dear." But it was the founding team there. They pivoted, use a trendy word, to what they're doing now. I think it's resilience of the founders to, will they listen? Are they coachable? Are they not arrogant? It's quite a lot of arrogant founders.
Do you find that you find quite a lot of arrogant founders, even at that early stage?
Like
And
if you say,
how does that arrogance come across? Is it like unwillingness to listen or rudeness or what is it?
oh, anything from "We're closing the round next week, you better act fast," and you think, "Oh, give me a break." Because they may have been told to, they have been told to say that, because it's good to close your round quickly, and you go, "Oh yeah, right, I'll be ready to write my check."
Oh,
And the other
God.
one is,
Oh, God.
the thing that is missing quite often is a proper competitive analysis, not some chart with tick 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 and everybody else has crosses. And if it's not deep tech, I like something protectable. Obviously, ideally have a patent, but you can't have that on software. But they'll go, "Oh, well, we're the best." I go, "Oh, right, okay, yeah, we're the best, we're the first." So it's those sorts of statements. But then
I
you have to
do.
balance that with, you want a founder who's going to be enthusiastic and sleep under the desk and work all hours and
You
stuff.
need you definitely need somebody that thinks they are the best or could be the best, right? Because
Yeah.
otherwise, like, what's like, it's not a great pitch to be like, I don't think we could ever be the best. I think I'm probably aiming for like
No,
fourth or
you're
fifth.
right. You're right.
You
You're
know
right.
what I mean? It's not
And
gonna.
sometimes they go, "And we could be 30 million revenues in 5 years." And you go, "Well, that's not very ambitious." So it's a balance, but there's a gut thing. I like to think my gut is good. It's probably all right most of the time. There's a gut thing. You think, "Oh dear." So it's a mixture of things. But
Do you
when you're a
ever
bit further along, you have to look at unit economics and all that, but you don't have a lot to go on at the very beginning.
Do you ever hear the one where it's like, who are your competitors? And then it's like, well, we're completely unique. We don't have any competitors if you take that.
Or the only competition is the status quo, that sort of thing. Get those.
I think the just to go back to the bit where I just lost it for a second, with laughter was what you were saying, just so we're everyone listening's on the same page. When you're trying to when you're trying to close a funding round, or get money in, get investment in, which is what that means, you want to, it's helpful sometimes to create some kind of urgency, because otherwise
It is.
it's very difficult, particularly the early stage where you're picking up 5,000s, 10,000s, or whatever it is in a go. It's a bit like herding cats. But on the flip side, trying to pretend that like things are closing next week is just a bit silly, isn't it? It just makes you
Get in
laugh.
while stocks last.
It's like those shops that always have a sale on, right?
Because people will say if they're raising now, they'll go going to close in late August, and you go, because it takes a long time to close these things legally. The other thing is people go, yeah, we'll be closing in 3 weeks. And I say, well, who's your lead? Because the lead investor sets the price. And they go, oh, we don't have one yet. I go, oh, okay. So, but you can't blame them, but
No,
it's
you've got to create,
not
I think you've got to
realistic.
create some, I think it's absolutely fine, because if you don't create urgency, then no one else is going to do it on your behalf. But you have to be a bit humble about it as well, and not do things that look a bit silly, like, you know, it's closing next week, it's your last chance, when it sort of isn't.
No, and then 6 months later, you see they're still raising. So, oops.
Yeah, exactly. That's that. Yeah, that's very interesting. So what did you, going to the Accurex thing, because Accurex are going like they're absolutely smashing it up, doing fantastically well. So if anyone in the UK has probably ever received an SMS text message from their GP, that's probably Accurex
Proportion of
system.
them.
Probably. I mean, I think they're a good, they're over 50% now, I think, well over in terms of GP surgeries. But that wasn't the pitch that you heard when you
No, well,
invested. So
that's
what was
why.
the pitch?
Well, it was this software to discourage GPs from prescribing antibiotics,
Like
antibiotic.
antibiotic resistance.
And again, it was very early stage. It was SEIS for me, a bit of a punt. But I just thought I was so impressed with Jacob and Lawrence's co-founder, the CTO. So, and probably I had just made that exit, my first exit. So I was probably feeling a bit flush, which is dangerous. So, everything collided. But what they have done really well is keeping their customers happy. I mean, if you meet a GP in a social situation or professionally and they go, you can't take that away from me, they've done really, really well at that.
I mean,
But
they've done a phenomenal job, absolutely. And now it looks like they're in the ambient scribe space.
yeah, done joint venture, So,
No, go on.
now I was going to say, I don't tend to go on the board of these companies. Actually, they've never asked me. But they haven't. I was thinking I should clarify that with Accurate. They haven't asked me, but other companies have. But I tend to be on the end of a WhatsApp, which is quite handy in the early days when then, negotiating themselves around the treacle of the NHS.
Well, let's talk about the NHS, right? So you came up through the graduate scheme. You've supported goodness knows how many entrepreneurs whose businesses sell to the NHS. I think you support various NHS sort of societies and committees and
Accelerators.
advisory bits and bobs. And so what, how would you kind of describe the current situation that you're seeing as it relates to technology, innovation, growth, digital health? Like how would you sort of explain it to somebody that was asking?
It is a bit dire, but it's going to get better, is my summary. Because there's the old story that VCs won't invest in companies that say they're going to sell into the NHS, which is a bit simplistic, because I think UK companies should try to sell into the NHS before they go abroad, because they'll get asked, well, why aren't you in your own home country? And it's a good thing if you get in. It's just very, very tough at the moment. And it has been for several years. You know, we had some central funding with NHSX several years ago, which was
Very
handing
good.
out non-dilutive funding, and it was all
Yeah.
much better. But again, it's a bit simple. But if you get approved economically to sell a drug by NICE, there's a funding mandate to go with it for the system to buy that drug. There is not the same with tech. So I'm hopeful because we have new leadership at MHRA. We've got Sam Roberts, who's great at NICE. We've got the NHS 10-year plan. I am just hoping that the procurement of health tech will get better,
I think, yeah, it's
improve.
super interesting. And I mean, I sit on the NHS England SME advisory board and
Oh, yeah.
various different things. And it's so difficult to really understand, I think. I mean, I've been doing some other things as well, so it's not like this, I've been solely trying to puzzle this out just in it. So, bear that in mind. But it's the NHS, I imagine, must be one of, if not the largest single procurer of health technology. Right, because if you look at any, because if you consider it to be roll up to one organization, right? Like even the largest insurers in Germany have, maybe 10 million lives, something like that, right? So the NHS must procure more technology if you use it in a loosest term. And so it's around the issue where I think it is, and it's exactly in the procurement piece, which is how does it become more efficient at adopting things that are better, and you can define better in a few different ways, clinically, economically, usably, whatever. How does it get better at adopting those things and swapping them out, basically? That's how I think about it, but might be wrong. That might be overly simplistic.
Well, one thing I always say is there's no pump right priming money. So there's this widely held belief that, oh, digital technology has to pay for itself. But even if it did, and paying for itself might mean removing two nurses' shifts, often that's very difficult to do, you need the pump priming funding at the beginning. But in answer to your question, the Peter Hames is now Microsoft, actually very successful exited entrepreneur from Sleepio, came over and said to a hospital chief exec, well, don't set up a room with bean bags and table tennis tables. Offer challenges out there that you need to solve in your organization. And I think the NHS should do that. There's this binary view almost that let a thousand flowers bloom around the country. But then you think, what big organization, massive organization, does that? So we've had Palantir, the federal federated data platform, procured centrally, which I think is good. We needed central spine, as it were. And then we have Epic and Cerner, which are big systems. Again, they are not so much national, but by the big organizations. But then often smaller tech companies have to find their way around, like, can they put themselves on top of Epic or Cerner? You know all this stuff. But I think there should be a bit more national procurement of some of these solutions, like ambient voice at
Ambient
the
scribes,
moment.
yeah.
Apparently, there are over 200 companies in the States, and the hospitals there don't know, and systems there don't know which to choose. So there could be some help in choosing which solution.
Or on a separate note, I think the ambient scribe thing is a really good example because that has scaled completely organically, pretty much in the system. It's like GPs started using them because they were like, oh my God, this helps me. It
Saves
wasn't, it was, and
time,
it,
yeah.
yeah, exactly. So that's a really good example of how technology sort of scales. But now we're in this situation where the regulation or governance of it has to kind of catch up. So there's only a handful of those companies that are classed as medical devices, I think. I don't know who they are. There's basically a split, right, between ones that
I
are
think
medical devices
actually
and ones that aren't.
Tandem Accurics is with us, is one of the very few. That it is interesting. And the other thing, I am an advisor to a big GP group, which is doing amazing stuff. So I have to be nice to GPs. But to have the GP with the risk of data protection with them national doesn't really make
That
sense,
doesn't
does
make
it?
sense.
And I'm
I
very
agree. I don't know how we've got ourselves into a pickle where the GP surgery, literal practice, is the kind of owner of the
of the
legal
data.
owner of that patient data, because it creates such, as you say, such a huge risk that then really makes it not in their interest to try new things that might put that data at risk, because they might be liable for a data breach.
And you can understand that. You know,
Completely.
equally, if you have a virtual hospital and you have a general physician or a frailty, you know, elderly medicine consultant, the responsibility they feel is with them to let that patient go. And that's a big burden for them. So I do think if we could wrap things around the NHS app and have a single patient record, that would be fantastic. I want that before I shuffle off and retire. Because we've been
That would be
talking
cool.
about it for so long, and I think the NHS app is underused, under known about. And that could be great because I do think, and I agree with the 10-year plan, we have to shift more of responsibility to individuals.
Yeah, I think the NHS app is this. I agree with you. It's kind of this incredible asset that they've sort of built, actually, to a pretty reasonably decent standard, without really making too much of a fuss about it. Like, it's actually pretty decent if you
Yeah,
look at what it was,
it's great.
and the team there works really hard on it. So I think that it would be great. But it's hard to see how it becomes great without a single patient record.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we had a Cambridge Health Network session last week where we talked about single patient record, and the will is there. I think it'll happen. And the NHS app's being the supplementary bits of it are being redesigned at the moment, which is great. It's going to be improved.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest things that people love about Poptox Healthy Heart Check is that it integrates back up with the app, so you can see it in the NHS app. It makes such a big difference to people. I mean, why can't you book your doctor's appointments through it and do all of this stuff? I mean, booking appointments through it will be really hard because of the completely random nature of those booking engines in every single GP surgery. But that would be the dream. That would be absolutely
And
incredible.
I know it's politically incorrect to say, but in COVID, when it was the d device or the system you used to get your the transaction to get your vaccine,
Yeah.
we deprived of East London, say, the Bengali community who might have an issue dealing with this, got their grandchildren to do it. And if there's enough of a motivation, you can make it work.
Yeah, I mean, I've never believed, I believe in adapting access based on needs and whatever those needs might be, and that might restrict access. But I've also never believed what I think is a little bit of a prevailing th theory in the NHS, which sort of correlates use of digital technology with socioeconomic factors.
Maybe we'll be.
They seem to correlate those sometimes quite closely. And we see some of the biggest uptake for our product in areas which are otherwise considered to be underserved, which is the kind of term that we use
So,
now.
do we have a break now?
Would you like to go to the door to get your package? Is your package
Yes.
there? Yes, Pam has got a delivery at the door, and that is brilliantly timed. So it
We
is our
get? I'll be
last
back.
commercial break. So we'll be back in 2 minutes after Pam's got her package, and we'll be back with the last part of today's show.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with myself, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Pam Garside, who is one of the leading voices in UK's digital health and health tech scene. So let's kind of return to this like UK-US, UK-Europe kind of interplay, Pam, if we can for a second. Where would you put the UK's healthcare system and the UK's kind of digital health tech sector versus the US and versus Europe? Like, how you said you thought earlier it was kind of important or a good thing for UK businesses to try and work with the NHS prior to going international and things like that. But how would you kind of compare the different scenes if you can.
Well, the US has a huge amount of capital, and the VCs are sitting on a lot, private equity is, and they're not so concerned about valuation. We're more conservative about valuing health tech startups. The US is also the biggest market in the world. It still is, despite what's happening with the big, beautiful bill. It's still the biggest market. So it's the big, it's the behemoth you want to enter. I see decks that I don't like, which say, we're going to go to the NHS and then we're going to go to the US. And the startups don't really understand either of them. So I don't like the US healthcare system because of its outcomes and divisions. But once you, it's difficult to crack. Hiring a commercial director for or chief revenue officer for the US, you'll pay them three times as much as you're paying a chief executive here. You probably know all this. You need regulatory approval. You need reimbursement approval. You may need FDA sort of approval. So it's complex. It's worth cracking. I don't know Europe that well, and it's interesting. I hang out with some European VCs, France, Denmark, Austria, German, and they're clearly very different markets, weirdly constrained sometimes by language. So I don't often hear of companies I've invested here going there unless they have a partner organization. The Scandinavian countries make most sense in terms of healthcare delivery. They're not bad on uptake. People still do want to come to the UK, though, because we have this national system, and they think that we would have a logical way of buying tech. We don't really, but I don't know whether that answers your
No,
question.
that's super interesting. I think that one of the things that people sometimes forget about the US system is that the economic incentives are completely different in some ways. Like, hospitals consider themselves to be businesses and therefore don't sometimes want to discharge people because they can monetize their stay in some way, shape, or form. So it's not that the things that you think around a UK or a nationalized or quasi-nationalized system that might make sense, may not make sense there at all.
And they're very much more open to economic discussions. People will talk about money. Doctors will talk about money much more openly, which is helpful when you're designing the incentives. And it's all incentive design. I mean, hospitals shouldn't want to keep patients in because of the DRG, the reimbursement codes, but the US responded really quickly years ago, set up ambulatory care, outpatient, pre-inpatient, post-outpatient, care homes, skilled nursing facilities. The whole sort of journey of a patient has all the incentives associated with it, which works. Everything's more expensive, of course, but yeah, we don't have that really.
What do you think is, I'm genuine, it's a genuine question. Like under Medicaid, which is for the lower income households, what is it that culturally, if the kind of culture is that they don't care about lower income people, or the belief is the government shouldn't have to step in, or where, because those people genuinely don't have healthcare, right? Or do they have some really basic, or do they not have any?
Yeah, it's aid for families with dependent children and, again, poor people. And Obamacare helped. By extending coverage helped quite a lot of people who had been in the top of the Medicare cohort, and that's being dissolved gradually. The sad thing is you'll end up at the city hospital, which takes everyone, because some of the private hospitals, I'm sure I'm going to get shot saying this, but that will divert the ambulance, or the ambulance will know that they're not to take them to the private. A lot of most The majority still of hospitals are private non-profit, but they still want to make excess revenues over expenses, even the ones run by the nuns. But the poor get really crummy care. And also, I mean, I always ask the cab drivers and people over there when I go, and they'll go, oh well, my wife went off her diet diabetes meds because we couldn't afford it. There's a lot of that. So chronic disease gets worse. They pitch up an A&E or the ER, and that's in the city hospitals. The city hospitals will be massively burdened by this new bill.
Right, because
Contraception
basically
services, all
what will
that.
happen is no one will get not net, well, preventative but ongoing care, and it will then just result in a huge acute problem that then ends up at the public hospital.
Yeah, and that will be in the red state, ironically, the southern red states. Now, if you Kaiser, I think is great. A lot of people in this country know Kaiser Permanente in on the west coast. It's on the east as well, but principally the west coast. And they will figure out ways. They are non-profit. They obviously make money. They're huge, but they will find ways of still helping the poor. So there are clearly lots of non-profit and charitable enterprises, but the new regime is not going to be kind to, if you're living in a trailer park in Alabama, this is not good. And it's going to bounce back at them. I know you can tell what I think.
No, I guess, but I think it's so different to the debates across Europe. I don't really know, like, about or are kind of like the prevailing view of access rights to healthcare. That I just find it really fascinating, particularly like you said at the start of the show, because America spends more on healthcare than any other country, I would imagine, gross and on a per capita basis.
No, it is ironic. Although they're very good at things like there was a company called Beacon which got acquired actually that we were I was helping them over here, and they're very good at things like here's what we spend on a Medicaid patient which is a dual, so it has chronic illness and a mental health condition. Here the state would say here's the amount of money you manage it for that much less and take half of the difference. They're really good at that stuff, and that was very good for everybody. I hope that's still going on. I'm not so familiar now with if there's enough margin to reduce it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, what was your view? How excited or kind of meh were you about the NHS 10-year plan?
Oh, well, my friend is now chair of Penny Dash, with whom I run Cambridge Health Network, is now chair of NHS England. No, I thought it was all right. It needs a delivery bit, but I think it's okay. I think it's okay. I was a little alarmed that the resident doctors are going to go on strike today.
Who's going on strike?
The junior doctors, the resident doctors are going to on strike. I disagree with that. I think they'll
Why
be getting
are they going on strike
more
again?
money. They want more money.
But didn't they get a settlement?
Yeah, they did. They're out for more. And then people will follow. I think that's not great. However, that's not the
Not happy.
10-year plan. I think it has the right shift. To prevention, to out of hospital, and it has the right and neighborhood health. All of that is really good. It needs some oomph in terms of the delivery, and I still think it needs pump priming money. But I was going to say corralling GPs. That's the wrong term. Enabling GPs to work together in neighborhood health because GP practice is changing so much, and with a new GP contract, I think there's lots of opportunities. And we are so good as a nation at some of the high tech stuff like genomics. We're the best at genomics, apparently worldwide. Genomics England's fantastic. We're going to screen every child. All of that is fantastic. I hope it's not just an aspiration and we can put the delivery behind it. The other thing, if you were to ask me what's the biggest issue in health systems around the world, it is workforce. And we haven't got a workforce plan yet. There's one coming to go alongside the 10-year plan. But no, I'm not down on it. I think it's got great ideas.
Yeah, I thought it was really ambitious. I
Would
mean, we
you?
were thrilled. We
Oh,
contributed
good.
to it through Wes's office. So we were absolutely thrilled because a lot of our
Yeah.
work feet well, a lot of the NHS work that we'd done featured in the plan. So we were absolutely over the moon about it. And I think in
And I
general
think they get the teams, DSIT and Wes's team. I think they get tech. They get it.
they definitely do. They
Yeah.
definitely do. I just think that what one of the things that I'm quite big on is that I don't think I think still there's an element of thinking about innovation in a way that's labeled that almost forgets that there's actually lots and lots and lots of medical devices and medical technology being procured at scale, and that
Yeah.
those two worlds need to kind of collide at some point to understand how you move from innovation in one-off programs and pilots and phases into actually really large procurement. And it's that translation that I think is really missing. And actually, a lot of the people that are involved, even on the innovation side in the NHS, don't have experience of NHS supply chain, procurement, that type of stuff. I think that's a that not that that would be in the plan necessarily, but I think that
No,
that's a
you're
big
right.
area.
And essentially, when I'm introducing my companies to chief execs of trusts, which I do, I help them because it takes
Sure.
ages to get there. And there are set. There are about six or seven I go to, and they've usually the fact the exec or exec team's been there a lot, quite a long time, and they're willing. They know the system, and they're willing to take a bit of a risk. And Joe Harrison's actually one of those who's also in
Yeah.
charge of the app at Milton Keynes. He's been there a long time. He'll take a risk on tech. And it's not that much of a risk. You say, yeah, let's come and try it. But yeah, it's I'm hopeful it's not just going to be constant pilots for these companies because they'll just run out of money doing pilots.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's really difficult. I mean, yeah, I go backwards and forwards. I mean, my background has always been in and around venture-backed tech, and so there's one part of me that thinks the NHS is no harder than doing B2B sales in any other vertical, you know? But then there's another part of me that thinks actually there are certain things that make it very unique and very complicated. So I kind of like flip-flop between these two, because if you think about, I don't know, if you've built an HR software for businesses over 10,000 people, for example, and that was your ICP, your ideal customer, it's not like there's kind of like some group of people that are out there independently trying to help you scale in those companies, or drive innovation in those companies. It's pretty tough. It's tough out there wherever. I think the big thing is when you're selling privately, economics are always a really big factor, like real commercial economics, not necessarily these slightly weird systematized health economics that are slightly political and slightly based on priorities. And there's a
And
much
then
clearer.
once you've been awarded the contract, somebody, judicially reviews it, or the last person in the chain says no, that sort of stuff,
Yeah, I mean that there, I think there is a, and this will happen hopefully through the Procurement Act that's just coming as well. But the NHS should be very focused on being the best possible customer it can be. I
And it's
don't
far from
believe,
that now.
yeah, like it could be a much better customer to particularly SMEs for sure. Irrespective of who it chooses to work with and what it chooses to spend its money on, it should really be trying to be the best possible customer. And I'm not sure that necessarily happens all of the time.
No, it doesn't.
No. So what do you think, going back to one of the points you made earlier, what is your view? Because I know that you're very connected into the venture world. What is your view that, well, what is the view you think around whether or not health tech businesses or digital health businesses should be trying to work with the NHS or should be avoiding the NHS as far as like venture goes?
No, I don't say don't work with the NHS. I say, get ready for it and works in a smart way. So I'm not one of those. I said at a meeting, why don't you, there's so many great young people in VCs. I said, why don't you do a swap in NHS England?
Oh my
Do
gosh.
some.
How amazing would that be?
And the person from NHS England, who shall remain nameless, said, oh no, you'd hate it. It's terrible in here. And
Oh my
that's
gosh.
really
Well, you've got
helpful.
to do a bit. You've got to sell it a bit. Come on.
I know. Well, I think things are not the greatest at the time and at the moment, but it will get to a point. I think you should do some swaps that people
Well,
really
I
should
so interestingly, I didn't say it
understand.
exactly that way, but what I said, I got asked one of the questions, like, what would I want, one of my wish lists? One of these conferences or whatever it was. And I said, I think you should get partner level VCs or senior analysts in the same room as NHS people so that they can both
And they
understand
should
what the
do
other.
job swaps, even if it's for a month, to
I think job
understand
swaps would
what's
be so
going
good.
on.
Can you imagine? That would be amazing. But otherwise, I don't understand how either side understands the world from the other
I
person's
know.
perspective.
I would do that.
Yeah.
But go on. I was just going to say there is no shortage of fantastic ideas at the top of the hopper coming in. Just no shortage of
No,
wonderful
exactly.
ideas.
But I don't think there's ever been. I mean, it's been such a vibrant sector for so long. I just think it's around how that I don't know, you want the ones that really help to get helped and the ones that aren't to get qualified out in a responsible way. That means,
Absolutely.
I think the worst is where people are sort of kept on life support.
We could have another whole hour on that.
Yeah, we could. Well, look, I've got 2 minutes left, and one of the things I do with everybody is, if you had to, what is your motto that you've relied on through your life and career that when things are difficult that you would pass on to listeners, that you think might help them potentially?
I think you have to take reasonable risks. I would never have gone to the States because somebody said to me, "You'll lose your place on the NHS career ladder." I wish I knew who it was, but I'd go back and say, "Thank you, I was counting on it." I went to live in Chile, and that was a risk. I do angel investing, and I'm addicted to risk. I think you have to and follow really good people. Either go and work for good people or invest in good people.
Brilliant. Thank you
Two
very much, Pam.
things.
Great having you on the show. Thank you so much, Pam
Thank you. It's
Gutsoe,
been fun.
everyone. Yeah, and
Again.
thanks to everyone listening. We'll be back again next week.